Here is a totally different story that we can recommend to you. We can wax rhapsodical in our praise, as the story is one of the finest pieces of literature it has been our good fortune to read. The theme is original and yet fantastic enough to make it rise head and shoulders on many contemporary scientification stories. You will not regret having read this marvelous tale.
The Colour Out of Space. West of Arkham, the hills rise wild, and there are valleys with deep woods that no axe has ever cut. There are dark, narrow glens where the trees slope fantastically and where thin brooklets trickle without ever having caught the glint of sunlight. On the gentler slopes there are farms, ancient and rocky, with squat, moss-coated cottages brooding eternally over old New England secrets in the lee of great ledges. But these are all vacant now, the wide chimneys crumbling and the shingled sides bulging perilously beneath low, gambrel roofs. The old folk have gone away. And foreigners do not like to live there. French Canadians have tried it, Italians have tried it, and the Poles have come and departed. It is not because of anything that can be seen or heard or handled, but because of something that is imagined. The place is not good for imagination, and it does not bring restful dreams at night. It must be this which keeps the foreigners away, for old Amy Pierce has never told them of anything he recalls from the strange days. Amy, whose head has been a little queer for years, is the only one who still remains, or whoever talks of the strange days, and he dares to do this because his house is so near the open fields and the travelled roads around Arkham. There was once a road over the hills and through the valleys that ran straight where the blasted heath is now, but people ceased to use it and a new road was laid, curving far towards the south. Traces of the old one can still be found amidst the weeds of returning wilderness, and some of them will doubtless linger even when half the hollows are flooded for the new reservoir. Then the dark woods will be cut down, and the blasted heath will slumber far below blue waters whose surface will mirror the sky and ripple in the sun. And the secrets of the strange days will be one with the deep's secrets, one with the hidden lore of old ocean, and all the mystery of primal earth. When I went into the hills and vales to survey for the new reservoir, they told me the place was evil. They told me this in Arkham, and because that is a very old town full of witch legends, I thought the evil must be something which grandmas had whispered to children through centuries. The name Blasted Heath seemed to me very odd and theatrical, and I wondered how it had come to the folklore of a Puritan people. Then I saw that dark westward tangle of glens and slopes for myself, and ceased to wonder at anything besides its own elder mystery. It was morning when I saw it, but shadow lurked always there. The trees grew too thickly, and their trunks were too big for any healthy New England wood. There was too much silence in the dim alleys between them, and the floor was too soft with the dank moss and mattings of infinite years of decay. In the open spaces, mostly along the line of the old road, there were little hillside farms, sometimes with all the buildings and standings, sometimes with only one or two, and sometimes with only a lone chimney or a fast-filling cellar. Weeds and briars reigned, and furtive wild things rustled in the undergrowth. Upon everything was a haze of restlessness and oppression, a touch of the unreal and the grotesque, as if some vital element of perspective or chiaroscuro were awry. I did not wonder that the foreigners would not stay, for this is no region to sleep in. It was too much like a landscape of Salvator Rosa, too much like some forbidden woodcut in a tale of terror. But even all this was not as bad as the blasted heath. I knew the moment I came upon it at the bottom of a spacious valley, for no other name could fit such thing, or any other thing fit such a name. It was as if the poet had coined the phrase from having seen this one particular region. It must, I thought as I viewed it, be the outcome of a fire, but why had nothing new ever grown across those 5 acres of grey desolation that sprawled open to the sky like a great spot eaten by acid in the woods and fields? It lay largely to the north of the ancient road line, but encroached a little on the other side. I felt an odd reluctance about approaching, and did so at last only because my business took me through and past it. There was no vegetation of any kind on that broad expanse, but only a fine grey dust or ash which no wind seemed ever to blow about. The trees near it were sickly and stunted, and many dead trunks stood or lay rotting at the rim. As I walked hurriedly by, I saw the tumbled bricks and stones of an old chimney and cellar on my right, and the yawning black moor of an abandoned well, whose stagnant vapours played strange tricks with the hues of the sunlight. Even the long, dark woodland climb beyond seemed welcome in contrast, and I marvelled no more at the frightened whispers of Arkham people. There had been no house or ruin near. Even in the old days, the place must have been lonely and remote. and at twilight, dreading to repass that ominous spot, I walked circuitously back to the town by the curving road on the south. I vaguely wished some clouds would gather, for an odd timidity about the deep, skyey voids above had crept into my soul. In the evening, I asked old people in Arkham about the blasted heath, and what was meant by that phrase, strange days, which so many evasively muttered. I could not, however, get any good answers, except that all the mystery was much more recent than I had dreamt. It was not a matter of old legendary at all, but something within the lifetime of those who spoke. It had happened in the 80s, and a family had disappeared or was killed. Speakers would not be exact, because they all told me to pay no attention to old Amy Pierce's crazy tales. I sought him out the next morning, having heard that he lived alone in the ancient tottering cottage where the trees first begin to get very thick. It was a fearsomely ancient place, and had begun to exude the faint miasmal odour which clings about houses that have stood too long. Only with persistent knocking could I rouse the aged man, and when he shuffled timidly to the door, I could tell he was not glad to see me. He was not so feeble as I expected, but his eyes drooped in a curious way, and his unkempt clothing and white beard made him seem very worn and dismal. Not knowing just how he could best be launched on his tales, I feigned a matter of business, told him of my surveying, and asked vague questions about the district. He was far brighter and more educated than I had been led to think, and before I knew it, had grasped quite as much of the subject as any man I had talked to in Arkham. He was not like other rustics I had known in the sections where the reservoirs were to be. From him there were no protests at the miles of old wooden farmland to be blotted out, though perhaps there would have been had not his home lain outside the bounds of the future lake. Relief was all he showed, relief at the doom of the dark ancient valleys through which he had roamed all his life. They were better under water now, better under water since the strange days. And with this opening, his husky voice sank low, while his body leant forward and his right forefinger began to point, shakily and impressively. It was then that I heard the story, and as the rambling voice scraped and whispered on, I shivered again and again despite the summer day. Often I had to recall the speaker from ramblings, piece out scientific points, which he knew only by a fading parrot memory of professor's talk, or bridge over gaps, where his sense of logic and continuity broke down. When he was done, I did not wonder that his mind had snapped a trifle, or that the folk of Arkham would not speak much of the blasted heath. I hurried back before sunset to my hotel, unwilling to have the stars come out above me in the open, and in the next day returned to Boston to give up my position. I could not go back to that dim chaos of old forest and slope again, or face another time that grey, blasted heath where the black well yawned deep beside the tumbled bricks and stones. The reservoir will soon be built now, and all those elder secrets will lie safe forever under watery fathoms. But even then, I do not believe that I would like to visit that country by night, at least not when the sinister stars are out, and nothing could bribe me to drink the new city water of Arkham. It all began, old Amy said, with a meteorite. Before that time there had been no wild legends at all since witch trials, and even then these western woods were not feared half so much as the small island in the Miskatonic, where the devil held court beside a curious stone altar older than the Indians. There were not haunted woods, as their fantastic dusk was never terrible till the strange days. And then there had come that white noontide cloud, that string of explosions in the air, and that pillar of smoke from the valley far in the wood. And by night, all Arkham had heard of the great white rock that fell out of the sky and bedded itself in the ground, beside the well at the Nahum Gardner place. And that was the house which had stood where the blasted heath was to come. The trim, white Nahum Gardner house, amidst its fertile gardens and orchards. Nahum had come to town to tell people about the stone, and had dropped in at Amy Pierce's on the way. Amy was 40 then, and all the queer things were fixed very strongly in his mind. He and his wife had gone with three professors from Miskatonic University, who hastened out the next morning to see the weird visitor from unknown stellar space, and had wondered why Nahum had called it so large the day before. It had shrunk, Nahum said, as he pointed the big brownish mound above the ripped earth and charred grass near the archaic well sweep in his front yard. But the wise man answered that stones do not shrink. Its heat lingered persistently, and Nahum declared that it had glowed faintly in the night. The professors tried it with a geologist's hammer and found it oddly soft. It was, in truth, so soft as to be almost plastic, and they gouged rather than chipped a specimen to take back to the college for testing. They took it in an old pail borrowed from Nahum's kitchen, for even the small piece refused to grow cool. On the trip back, they stopped at Amy's to rest, and seemed thoughtful when Mrs. Pierce remarked that the fragment was growing smaller and burning the bottom of the pail. Truly, it was not large, but perhaps they had taken less than they thought. The day after that, this was in June of 82, the professors had trooped out again in great excitement. As they passed Ammies, they told him what queer things the specimen had done and how it had faded wholly away when they put it in a glass beaker. The beaker had gone too, and the wise men talked of the strange stone's affinity for silicon. It had acted quite unbelievably in that well-ordered laboratory, doing nothing at all and showing no occluded gases when heated on charcoal, being wholly negative in the borax bead, and soon proving itself absolutely non-volatile at any producible temperature, including that of the oxyhydrogen blowpipe. On an anvil, it appeared highly malleable, and in the dark its luminosity was very marked. Stubbornly refusing to grow cool, it had soon had the college in a state of real excitement, and when upon heating before the spectroscope, it displayed shining bands unlike any known colours of the normal spectrum. There was much breathless talk of new elements, bizarre optical properties, and other things which puzzled men of science are wont to say when faced by the unknown. Hot as it was, they tested it in a crucible with all the proper reagents. Water did nothing, hydrochloric acid was the same, nitric acid and even aqua regia merely hissed and spattered against its torrid invulnerability. Ammy had difficulty in recalling all these things, but recognized some solvents as I mentioned them in the usual order of use. There were ammonia and caustic soda, alcohol and ether, nauseous carbon disulfide, and a dozen others. But although the weight grew steadily less as time passed, and the fragments seemed to be slightly cooling, there was no change in the solvents to show that they had attacked the substance at all. It was a metal, though, beyond a doubt. It was magnetic, for one thing, and after its immersion in the acid, solvents there seemed to be faint traces of the Wildmannsstern figures found on meteoric iron. When the cooling had grown very considerable, the testing was carried on in glass, and it was in a glass beaker that they left all the chips made of the original fragment during the work. The next morning, both chips and beaker were gone, without a trace, and only a charred spot marked the place on the wooden shelf where they had been. All this the professors told Ammy as they paused at his door, and once more he went with them to see the stony messenger from the stars, though this time his wife did not accompany. It was now most certainly shrunk, and even the sober professors could not doubt the truth of what they saw. All around the dwindling brown lump near the well was a vacant space, except where the earth had caved in, and whereas it had been a good 7 feet across the day before, it was now scarcely 5. It was still hot, and the sages studied its surface curiously as they detached another and larger piece with hammer and chisel. They gouged deeply this time, and as they pried away the smaller mass, they saw the core of the thing was not quite homogeneous. They had uncovered what seemed to be the side of a large coloured globule embedded in the substance. The colour, which resembled some of the bands in the meteor's strange spectrum, was almost impossible to describe. It was only by analogy that they called it colour at all. Its texture was glossy, and upon tapping it appeared to promise both brittleness and hollowness. One of the professors gave it a smart blow with a hammer, and it burst with a nervous little pop. Nothing was emitted, and all trace of the thing vanished with the puncturing. It left behind a hollow, spherical space about 3 inches across, and all thought it probable that others would be discovered as the enclosing substance wasted away. Conjecture was vain, so after a futile attempt to find additional globules by drilling, the seekers left again with a new specimen, which proved, however, as baffling as the laboratory as its predecessor. Aside from being almost plastic, having heat, magnetism, and slight luminosity, cooling slightly in powerful acids, possessing an unknown spectrum, wasting away in air, and attacking silicon compounds with mutual destruction as a result, it presented no identifying features whatsoever. And at the end of the test, the college scientists were forced to own that they could not place it. It was nothing of this earth, but a piece of the great outside, and as such, dowered with outside properties, and obedient to outside laws. That night there was a thunderstorm, and when the professors went out to Nahum's the next day, they met with bitter disappointment. The stone, magnetic as it had been, must have had some peculiar electrical property, for it had drawn the lightning, as Nahum said, with a singular persistence. 6 times within an hour the farmer saw the lightning strike the furrow in the front yard, and when the storm was over, nothing remained but a ragged pit by the ancient well sweep, half choked with caved in earth. Digging had borne no fruit, and the scientists verify the fact of the utter vanishment. The failure was total, so that nothing was left to do but go back to the laboratory and test again the disappearing fragment left carefully cased in lead. That fragment lasted a week, at the end of which nothing of value had been learned of it. When it had gone, no residue was left behind, and in time the professors felt scarcely sure that they had indeed seen with waking eyes that cryptic vestige of the fathomless gulfs outside, that lone, weird message from other universes and other realms of matter, force, and entity. As was natural, the Arkham papers made much of the incident with its collegiate sponsoring and sent reporters to talk with Nahum Gardner and his family. At least one Boston Daily also sent a scribe, and Nahum quickly became a kind of local celebrity. He was a lean, genial person of about 50, living with his wife and 3 sons on the pleasant farmstead in the valley. He and Ammy exchanged visits frequently, as did their wives, and Ammy had nothing but praise for him after all these years. He seemed slightly proud of the notice his place had attracted and talked often of the meteorite in the succeeding weeks. That July and August were hot, and Nahum worked hard at his haying in a 10-acre pasture across Chapman's Brook, his rattling wain wearing deep ruts in the shadowy lanes between. The labor tired him more than it had in other years, and he felt that age was beginning to tell on him. Then fell the time of fruit and harvest. The pears and apples slowly ripened, and Nahum vowed that his orchards were prospering as never before. The fruit was growing to phenomenal size and unwonted gloss, and in such abundance that extra barrels were ordered to handle the future crops. But with the ripening came a sore disappointment, for all of that gorgeous array of specious lusciousness, not a single jot was fit to eat. Into the fine flavour of the pears and apples had crept a stealthy bitterness and sickishness, so that even the smallest of bites produced a lasting disgust. It was the same with the melons and tomatoes, and Nahum sadly saw that his entire crop was lost. Quick to connect events, he declared the meteorite had poisoned the soil, and thanked heaven that most of the other crops were in upland lot along the road. Winter came early, and was very cold. Ammi saw Nahum less often than usual, and observed that he had begun to look worried. The rest of his family, too, seemed to have grown taciturn, and were far from steady in their church-going or their attendance at the various social events of the countryside. For this reserve or melancholy, no cause could be found, though all the household confessed now to their poor health and a feeling of vague disquiet. Nahum himself gave the most definite statement of anyone who saw he was not disturbed about certain footprints in the snow. They were the usual winter prints of red squirrels, white rabbits, and foxes, but the brooding farmer professed to see something not quite right about their nature and arrangement. He was never specific, but appeared to think that they were not as characteristic of the anatomy and habits of squirrels and rabbits and foxes as they ought to be. Ammi listened without interest to this talk until one night he drove past Nahum's house in his sleigh on the way back from Clark's Corners. There had been a moon, and a rabbit had run across the road, and the leaps of that rabbit were longer than either Ammi or his horse liked. The latter, indeed, had almost run away when brought up by a firm rein. Thereafter, Ammi gave Nahum's tails more respect, and wondered why the gardener dogs seemed so cowed and quivering every morning. They had, it developed, nearly lost the spirit to bark. In February, the McGregor boys from Meadow Hill were out shooting woodchucks, and not far from the gardener place bagged a very peculiar specimen. The proportions of its body seemed slightly altered in a queer way, impossible to describe, while its face had taken on an expression that no one ever saw on a woodchuck before. The boys were genuinely frightened and threw the thing away at once, so that only their grotesque tales had ever reached the people of the countryside. But the shying of horses near Nahum's house had now become an acknowledged thing, and all the basis for the cycle of whispered legend was fast taking form. People vowed that the snow melted faster around Nahum's than it did anywhere else, and early in March there was an awed discussion in Potter's General Store at Clark's Corners. Stephen Rice had driven past Gardner's in the morning and had noticed the skunk cabbages coming up through the mud by the woods near the road. Never were things of such size seen before, and they held strange colours that could not be put into any words. Their shapes were monstrous, and the horse had snorted at an odour which struck Stephen as wholly unprecedented. That afternoon, several persons drove past to see the abnormal growth, and all agreed that plants of that kind ought never to sprout in a healthy world. The bad fruit of the fall was freely mentioned, and it went from mouth to mouth that there was poison in Nahum's ground. Of course it was the meteorite, and remembering how strange the men from the college had found that stone to be, several farmers spoke about the matter to them. One day they paid Nahum a visit, but having no love of wild tales and folklore, were very conservative in what they inferred. The plants were certainly odd, but all skunk cabbages are more or less odd in shape and hue. Perhaps some mineral element from the stone had entered the soil, but it would soon be washed away. And as for the footprints and frightened horses, of course this was mere country talk, and such a phenomenon as the aerolite would have be certain start. There was really nothing for serious men to do in such cases of wild gossip, for superstitious rustics will say and believe anything. And so, throughout the strange days, the professors stayed away in contempt. Only one of them, when given two files of dust for analysis in a police job over a year and a half later, recalled the queer colour of that skunk cabbage had been very like one of the anomalous bands of light shown by the meteor fragment in this college spectroscope, and like the brittle globule found embedded in the stone from the abyss. The samples of this analysis case gave the same odd bands at first, though later they lost the property. The trees budded prematurely around Nahum, and at night they swayed ominously in the wind. Nahum's second son, Thaddeus, a lad of 15, swore that they swayed also when there was no wind, but even the gossips wouldn't credit this. Certainly, however, restlessness was in the air. The entire Gardner family developed the habit of stealthy listenings, though not for any sound which they could consciously name. The listening was indeed rather a product of moments where the consciousness seemed to half slip away. Unfortunately, such moments increased week by week till it became common speech that something was wrong with all Nahum's folk. When the early saxifrage came and it had another strange colour, not quite like that of the skunk cabbage, but plainly related and equally unknown to anyone who saw it. Nahum took some blossoms to Arkham and showed them to the editor of the Gazette, but that dignitary did no more than write a humorous article about him, in which the dark fears of rustics were held up to polite ridicule. It was a mistake of Nahum's to tell a stolid city man about the way the great overgrown mourning cloak butterflies behaved in connection to these saxifrages. April brought a kind of madness to the country folk and began the disuse of the road past Nahum's, which led to its ultimate abandonment. It was next the vegetation. All the orchard trees blossomed forth in strange colours, and through the stony soil of the yard and adjacent pasturage there sprang up a bizarre growth which only a botanist could connect with the proper flora of the region. No sane, wholesome colours were anywhere to be seen except in the green grass and leafage, but everywhere else these hectic and prismatic variants of some diseased underlying primary tone, without a place amongst the known tints of earth. The Dutchman's breeches became a thing of sinister menace, and the bloodroots grew insolent in their chromatic perversion. Amy and the gardeners thought that most of the colours had a sort of haunting familiarity, and decided they reminded one of the brittle globule in the meteor. Nahum ploughed and sowed the 10-acre pasture in the upland lot, but did nothing with the land around the house. He knew it would be of no use, and he hoped that the summer's strange growth would draw all the poison from the soil. He was prepared for almost anything now, and had grown used to the sense of something near him, waiting to be heard. The shunning of his house by neighbours told on him, of course, but it told on his wife more. The boys were better off being at school each day, but they could not help being frightened by the gossip. Thaddeus, an especially sensitive youth, suffered the most. In May, the insects came, and Nahum's place became a nightmare of buzzing and crawling. Most of the creatures seemed not quite usual in their aspects and motions, and their nocturnal habits contradicted all former experience. The gardeners took to watching at night, watching in all directions at random for something they could not tell what. It was then that they all owned that Thaddeus had been right about the trees. Mrs. Gardiner was the next to see it from the window as she watched the swollen boughs of a maple against a moonlit sky. The boughs surely moved, and there was no wind. It must be the sap. Strangeness had come into everything growing now, yet it was none of Nahum's family at all who made the next discovery. Familiarity had dulled them, and what they could not see was glimpsed by a timid windmill salesman from Bolton, who drove by one night in ignorance of the country legends. What he told in Arkham was given a short paragraph in the Gazette, and it was there that all the farmers, Nahum included, saw it first. At night, there had been a dark and the buggy lamps faint, but around a farm in the valley, which everyone knew from the account must be Nahum's, the darkness had been less thick. A dim, though distinct luminosity seemed to inhere in all the vegetation, grass, leaves, and blossoms alike, while at one moment a detached piece of the phosphorescent appeared to stir furtively in the yard near the barn. The grass had so far seemed untouched, and cows were freely pastured in the lot near the house. But towards the end of May, the milk began to be bad. Then Nahum had the cows driven to the uplands, after which this trouble ceased. Not long after this, the changing grass and leaves became apparent to the eye. All the verdure was going grey, and was developing a highly singular quality of brittleness. Amy was now the only person who ever visited the place, and his visits were becoming fewer and fewer. When school closed, and the gardeners were virtually cut off from the world, sometimes let Amy do their errands in town. They were failing curiously, both physically and mentally, and no one was surprised when the news of Mrs. Gardiner's madness stole around. It happened in June, about the anniversary of the meteor's fall, and the poor woman screamed about things in the air which she could not describe. In her ravings there was not a single specific noun, but only verbs and pronouns. Things moved and changed and fluttered, and ears tingled to impulses which were not wholly sounds. Something was taken away. She was being drained of something. Something was fastening itself on her that ought not to be. Someone must make it keep off. Nothing was ever still in the night. The walls and windows shifted. Nahum did not send her to the county asylum, but let her wander about the house as long as she was harmless to herself and others. Even when her expression changed, or he did nothing. But when the boys grew afraid of her, and Thaddeus nearly fainted away the way she made faces at him, he decided to keep her locked in the attic. By July, she had ceased to speak and crawled on all fours, and before that month was over, Nahum got the mad notion she was slightly luminous in the dark, as he now clearly saw was the case with the nearby vegetation. It was little before this that the horses had stampeded. Something had aroused them in the night, and their neighing and kicking in the stalls had been terrible. There seemed virtually nothing to do to calm them, and when Nahum opened the stable door, they all bolted out like frightened woodland deer. It took a week to track all four, and when found, they were seen to be quite useless and unmanageable. Something had snapped in their brains, and each one had to be shot for its own good. Nahum borrowed a horse from Amy for his haying, but found it would not approach the barn. It shied, balked, and whinnied, and in the end, he could do nothing but drive it into the yard while the men used their own strength to get the heavy wagon near enough to the hayloft for convenient pitching. And all the while, the vegetation was turning grey and brittle. Even the flowers, whose hues had been so strange, were greying now, and the fruit was coming out grey and dwarfed and tasteless. The asters and goldenrod bloomed grey and distorted, and the roses and zinnias and hollyhocks in the front yard were such blasphemous-looking things that Nahum's oldest boy, Zenas, cut them down. The strangely puffed insect died about that time. Even the bees that had left their hives and taken to the woods. By September, all the vegetation was fast crumbling to a greyish powder, and Nahum feared that the trees would die before the poison was out of the soil. His wife now had spells of terrific screaming, and he and the boys were in a constant state of nervous tension. They shunned people now, and when school opened, the boys did not go. But it was Ammy, on one of his rare visits, who first realized the well water was no longer good. It had an evil taste that was not exactly fetid nor exactly salty, and Ammy advised his friend to dig another well on higher ground to use till the soil was good again. Nahum, however, ignored the warning, for he had by that time become calloused to strange and unpleasant things. He and the boys continued to use the tainted supply, drinking it as listlessly and mechanically as they ate their meager and ill-cooked meals and did their thankless and monotonous chores through the aimless days. There was something of a stolid resignation about them all, as if they walked half in another world, between lines of nameless guards to a certain and familiar doom. Thaddeus went mad in September after a visit to the well. He had gone with a pail and had come back empty-handed, shrieking and waving his arms, and sometimes lapsing into an inane titter or a whisper about the moving colours down there. Two-in-one family was pretty bad, but Nahum was very brave about it. Oh, brave Nahum. He let the boy run about for a week till he began stumbling and hurting himself, and then he shut him in an attic room across the hall from his mother's. The way they screamed at each other from behind their locked doors was very terrible, especially to poor little Merwin, who fancied they talked in some terrible language that was not of Earth. Merwin was getting frightfully imaginative, and his restlessness was worse after the shutting away of the brother who had been his greatest playmate. Almost the same time, the mortality amongst the livestock commenced. Poultry turned greyish and died very quickly, their meat being found dry and noisome upon cutting. Hog grew inordinately fat, and then suddenly began to undergo loathsome changes which no one could explain. Their meat was, of course, useless, and Nahum was at his wits' end. No rural veterinary would approach his place, and the city veterinary from Arkham was openly baffled. The swine began growing grey and brittle and falling to pieces before they died, and their eyes and muzzles developed singular alterations. It was very inexplicable, for they had never been fed from the tainted vegetation. Then something struck the cows. Certain areas, or something, sometimes the whole body, would be uncannily shriveled or compressed, and atrocious collapses or disintegrations were common. In the last stages, and death was always the result, there would be a greying and turning brittle like that which beset the hogs. There could be no question of poison, for all the cases occurred in a locked and undisturbed barn. No bites of prowling things could have brought the virus, because what live beast of Earth can pass through solid obstacles? It must only be natural disease. Yet what disease could wreak such results was beyond anyone's guessing. When the harvest came, there was not an animal surviving on the place, for the stock and poultry were dead, and the dogs had run away. These dogs, three in number, had all vanished one night and were never heard of again. The five cats had left some time before, but their going was scarcely noticed, since now there seemed to be no mice, and only Mrs. Gardiner had made pets of the graceful felines. On the 19th of October, Nahum staggered into Ammy's house with hideous news. The death had come to poor Thaddeus in his attic room, and it had come in a way which could not be told. Nahum had dug a grave in the railed family plot behind the barn, and had put therein what he found. There could have been nothing from outside for the small barred window and locked door were intact, but it was much as it had been in the barn. Ammy and his wife consoled the stricken man as best they could, but shuddered as they did so. Stark terror seemed to cling round the gardeners and all they touched, and the very presence in one in the house was a breath from regions unaimed and unaimable. Ammy accompanied Nahum home with the greatest reluctance and did what he might to calm the hysterical sobbing of little Merwin. Zenas needed no calming. He had come of late to do nothing but stare into space and obey what his father told him, and Ammy thought that his fate was very merciful. Now and then Merwin's screams were answered faintly from the attic, and in response to an inquiring look, Nahum said that his wife was getting very feeble. When night approached, Ammy managed to get away, for not even friendship could make him stay in that spot when the glow of vegetation began, and the trees may or may not have swayed without wind. It was really lucky for Ammy that he was not more imaginative. Even as things were, his mind was bent ever so slightly. But had he been able to connect and reflect with all that portents around him, he might inevitably have turned into a total maniac. In the twilight, he hastened home, the screams of the mad woman and the nervous, faint child ringing horrible in his ears. 3 days later, Nahum burst into Ammy's kitchen in the early morning, and in the absence of his host stammered out desperate tale once more, while Mrs. Pierce listened in a clutching fright. It was little Merwin this time. He was gone. He had gone out late at night with a lantern and a pail for water, and had never come back. He'd been going to pieces for days and hardly knew what he was about. Screamed at everything. There'd been a frantic shriek from the yard then, but before the father could get to the door, the boy was gone. There was no glow from the lantern he had taken, and any of the child himself, no trace. At the time, Nahum had thought the lantern and pail were gone too, but when dawn came and the man had plodded back from his all-night search of the woods and fields, he found some various curious things near the well. There was a crushed and apparently somewhat melted mass of iron, which had certainly been the lantern, while a bent pail and twisted iron hoops beside it, both half-fused, seemed to hint at the remnants of the pail. That was all. Nahum was past imagining. Mrs. Pierce was blank, and Ammy, when he had reached home and heard the tale, could give no guess. Merwin was gone, and there would be no use in telling the people around, who shunned all gardeners now. No use either in telling the city people at Arkham, who laughed at everything. Thad was gone, and now Merwin was gone. Something was creeping and creeping and waiting to be seen and heard. Nahum would go soon, and he wanted Ammi to look after his wife and Zenas if they survived him. It must be all a judgment of some sort, though he could not fancy what for, since he had always walked uprightly in the Lord's ways so far as he knew. For over 2 weeks, Ammi saw nothing of Nahum. Then, worried about what might have happened, he overcame his fears and paid the gardener a place of visit. There was no smoke from the great chimney, and for a moment the visitor was apprehensive of the worst. The aspect of the whole farm was shocking. Greyish, withered grass and leaves on the ground, vines falling in brittle wreckages from archaic wall and gables, and great bare trees clawing up at the grey November sky with a studied malevolence which Ammi could not feel but had come from some subtle change in the tilt of the branches. But Nahum was alive after all. He was weak and lying in a couch in the low-ceiled kitchen, but perfectly conscious and able to give simple orders to Zenas. The room was deadly cold. As Ammi visibly shivered, the host shouted huskily to Zenas for more wood. Wood, indeed, was sorely needed, since the cavernous fireplace was unlit and empty, and with a cloud of soot blowing about in the chill wind that came down the chimney. Presently Nahum asked him if the extra wood had made him any more comfortable, and then Ammi saw what had happened. The stoutest cord had broken at last, and the hapless farmer's mind was proof against more sorrow. Questioning tactfully, Ammi could get no clear data at all about the missing Zenas. "In the well. He lives in the well," was all that the clouded father would say. Then there flashed across the visitor's mind a sudden thought of the mad wife, and he changed his line of inquiry. "Nabby? Why, here she is," was the surprised response of poor Nahum, and Ammi soon saw that he must search for himself. Leaving the harmless babbler on the couch, he took the keys from their nail beside the door and climbed the creaking stairs to the attic. It was very close and noisome up there, and no sound could be heard in any direction. Of the four doors inside, only one was locked, and on this he tried the various keys on the ring he had taken. The third key proved the right one, and after some fumbling, Ammi threw open the low white door. It was quite dark inside, for the window was small and half obscured by the crude wooden bars, and Ammi could see nothing at all on the white plank floor. The stench was beyond enduring, and before proceeding further he ought to retreat to another room and again turn with his lungs filled with breathable air. When he did enter, he saw something dark in the corner, and upon seeing it more clearly, he screamed outright. While he screamed, he thought he saw a momentary cloud eclipse the window, and a second later, he felt himself brushed as if by some hateful current of vapor. Strange colors danced before his eyes, and had not a present horror numbed him, he would have thought of the globule and the meteor and the geologist's hammer had shattered, and the morbid vegetation that had sprouted in the spring. As it was, he thought only of the blasphemous monstrosity which confronted him, and which all too clearly had shared the nameless fate of young Thaddeus and the livestock. But the terrible thing about the horror was that it very slowly and perceptibly moved as it continued to crumble. Ammi would give no added particulars of this scene, but the shape of the corners does not reappear in his tale as a moving object. There are things which cannot be mentioned, and what is done in common humanity is sometimes cruelly judged by the law. I gather that no moving thing was left in that attic room, and that to leave anything capable of motion there would have been a deed so monstrous as to damn any accountable being to eternal torment. Anyone but a stolid farmer would have fainted or gone mad, but Ammi walked consciously through that low doorway and locked the accursed secret behind him. There would be Nahum to deal with now. He must be fed and tended, and removed to some place where he could be cared for. Commencing his descent to the dark stairs, Ammi heard a thud below him. He even thought a scream had been suddenly choked off, and recalled nervously the clammy vapour which had brushed by him on that frightful room above. What presence had a cry and entry started up? Halted by some vague fear, he heard still further sounds below. Indubitably there was a sort of heavy dragging and a most detestably sticky noise, as of some fiendish and unclean species of suction. With an associative sense goaded to feverish heights, he thought unaccountably of what he had seen upstairs. Good God! What eldritch dream world was this into which he had blundered? He dared move neither backwards nor forward, but stood there trembling at the black curve of the boxed-in staircase. Every trifle of the scene burned itself into his brain. The sounds, the sense of dread expectancy, the darkness, the steepness of the narrow steps, and, merciful heaven, the faint but unmistakable luminosity of all the woodwork in sight. Steps, sides, exposed lathes, and beams alike. Then there burst forth a frantic whinny from Ammi's horse outside, followed at once by a clatter which told of a frenzied runaway. In another moment, horse and buggy had gone beyond earshot, leaving the frightened man on the dark stairs to guess what had sent them. But that was not all. There had been another sound out there, a sort of liquid splash. Water. It must have been the well. He had left Hero untied near it, and a buggy wheel must have brushed the coping and knocked in a stone. And still, the pale phosphorescence glowed in that detestably ancient woodwork. God, how old the house was! most of it built before 1700. A feeble scratching on the door downstairs now sounded distinctly, and Amy's grip tightened on a heavy stick he had picked up in the attic for some purpose. Slowly nerving himself, he finished his descent and walked boldly towards the kitchen. But he did not complete the walk, because what he sought was no longer there. It had come to meet him, it was still alive, and after a fashion. Whether it had crawled or whether it had been dragged by an external force, Amy could not say. But the death had been at it. Everything had happened in the last half hour, but collapse, graying and disintegration were already far advanced. There was a horrible brittleness and dry fragments were scaling off. Amy could not touch it, but looked horridly into the distorted parody that had been a face. "What was it, Nahum? What was it?" he whispered, and the cleft, bulging lips were just able to crackle out a final answer. "Nothing. Nothing. The colour. It burns. Cold and wet, but it burns. It lived in the well. I seen it. Kind of smoke. Just like the flowers last spring. The well shone at night. Thad and Merwin and Zenas. Everything alive. Sucking the life out of everything. And that stone. Must have come in that stone. Poisoned the whole place. Don't know what it wants. That round thing the men from the college dug out in the stone. And smashed it. It's that same colour. Just the same. Like the flowers and plants. Must have been more of them. Seeds. Seeds. They growed. I seen it the first time this week. Must have got strong on Zenas. It's a big boy. Full of life. It beats down your mind, then gets you. Burns you up. And the well water. You was right about that. Evil water. Zenas never came back from the well. Can't get away. Draws you. You know something's coming. Tain't no use. Seen it time and again. Zenas was took. Where's Nabby, Amy? My head's no good. Don't know how long since I fed her. It'll get her if we ain't careful. Just a colour. Her face is glittin' to have that colour sometimes towards night. And it burns and sucks. It comes from some place where things ain't as they is here. One of them professors said so. He's right. Look out, Amy. It'll do something more. Sucks the life out. But that was all. That which spoke could speak no more because it had completely caved in. Amy laid a red checked tablecloth over what was left and reeled out the back door into the fields. He climbed the slope to the 10-acre pasture and stumbled home by the north road and woods. He could not pass that well from which his horses had run away. He had looked at it through the window and seen that no stone was missing from the rim. Then the lurching buggy had not dislodged anything after all. The splash had been something else. Something which went into the well after it had done with poor Nahum. When Amy reached the house, the horses and buggy had arrived before him and thrown his wife into fits of anxiety. Reassuring her without explanations, he set at once for Arkham and notified the authorities that the Gardner family was no more. He indulged in no details but merely told of the deaths of Nahum and Nabby, that of Thaddeus being already known, and mentioned the cause seemed to be the strange, strange ailment which had killed the livestock. He also stated that Merwin and Zenas had disappeared. There was considerable questioning at the police station, and in the end, Amy was compelled to take three officers to the Gardner farm, together with the coroner, the medical examiner, and the veterinary who had treated the diseased animals. He went much against his will, for the afternoon was advancing and he feared the fall of night over that accursed place, but it was some comfort to have so many people with him. The six men drove out in a Democrat wagon, following Amy's buggy, and arrived at the pest-ridden farmhouse at 4 o'clock. Used as the officers were to gruesome experiences, not one remained unmoved at what they found in the attic and under the red checkered tablecloth on the floor below. The whole aspect of the farm, with its grey desolation, was terrible enough, but those two crumbling objects were beyond all bounds. No one could look at them long, and even as the medical examiner admitted there was very little to examine. Specimens could be analysed, of course, so he busied himself in obtaining them. And here it develops that a very puzzling aftermath occurred at that college laboratory where the two files of dust were finally taken. Under the spectroscope, both samples gave off an unknown spectrum, in which many of the baffling bands were precisely like those which the strange meteor had yielded in the previous year. The property of emitting the spectrum vanished in a month, the dust and thereafter consisting mainly of alkaline phosphate carbonates. Amy would not have told the men about the well if he had thought they meant to do anything then and there. It was getting towards sunset and he was anxious to be away.
but he couldn't help glancing nervously at the stony curb by the Great Sweep, and when a detective questioned him, he admitted that Nahum had feared something down there, so much so that he'd never even thought of searching it for Merwin or Zenus. After that, nothing would do but that they empty and explore the well immediately, so Mammy had to wait, trembling, while pail after pail of rank water was hauled up and splashed onto the soaking ground outside. The men sniffed in disgust at the fluid, and towards the last held their noses against the fetor they were uncovering. It was not so long a job as they'd feared it would be, since the water was phenomenally low. There is no need to speak to exactly what they found. Merwin and Zenus were both there, in part, though the vestiges were mainly skeletal. There was also a small deer and a large dog in about the same state, and a number of bones of smaller animals. The ooze and slime at the bottom seemed inexplicably porous and bubbling, and a man who descended on handholds with a long pole found that he could sink a wooden shaft to any depth in the mud of the floor without meeting solid obstruction. Twilight had now fallen, and lanterns were brought from the house. Then, when it was seen that nothing further could be gained from the well, everyone went indoors and conferred in the ancient sitting room while the intermittent light of the spectral half-moon played wanly on the grey desolation outside. The men were frankly nonplussed by the entire case and could find no convincing common element to link the strange vegetable condition, the unknown disease of livestock and humans, and the unaccountable deaths of Merwin and Zenus in the tainted well. They had heard the common country talk, it's true, but could not believe that anything contrary to natural law had occurred. No doubt the meteor had poisoned the soil, but the illness of person and animals who had eaten nothing grown in that soil was another matter. Was it the well water? Very possibly. It might be a good idea to analyze it. But what peculiar madness could have made both boys jump in the well? Their deeds were so similar, and the fragments show they had both suffered from the grey, brittle death. Why was everything so grey and brittle? It was the coroner, seated near a window overlooking the yard, who first noticed the glow about the well. Night had fully set in, and all the aberrant ground seemed faintly luminous with more than the fitful moonbeams. But this new glow was something definite and distinct, and appeared to shoot up from the black pit like a softened ray from a searchlight, giving dull reflection in the little ground pools where the water had been emptied. It had a very queer colour, and as the men clustered around the window, Ammy gave a violent start, for this strange beam of ghastly miasma was to him of no unfamiliar hue. He'd seen that colour before, and feared to think what it might mean. He'd seen it in the nasty, brittle globule in that aerolite 2 summers ago, and seen it in the crazy vegetation in the springtime, had thought that he had seen it for an instant that very morning against the small barred window of that terrible attic room where a nameless thing had happened. It flashed there for a second, and a clammy and hateful current of vapour had brushed past him, and then poor Nahum had been taken by something of that colour. He had said so at the last, said that it was like the globule in the plants. After that had come the runaway in the yard and the splash in the well, and now the well was belching forth in the night, a pale, insidious beam of the same demoniac taint. It does credit to the alertness of Ammi's mind that he puzzled even at those tense moments over the point which was essentially scientific. He could not but wonder at his gleaning of the same impression from the vapour glimpsed in the daytime, against a window opening in the morning sky, and from a nocturnal exhalation seen as phosphorescent mist against the black and blasted landscape. It wasn't right. It was against nature. He thought of those terrible last words of his stricken friend. It come from some place where things ain't as they is here. One of them professors said so. All three horses outside, tied to a pair of shriveled saplings by the road, were now neighing and pawing frantically. The wagon driver started for the door to do something, but Ammy laid a shaky hand on his shoulder. "Don't go out there," he whispered. "There's more to this nor than we know. Nahum said something lived in the well that sucks your life out. He says it must be some growed from a brown ball like one we seen in the meteor stone that fell a year ago June. Sucks and burns, he said, and is just a cloud of colour like that light out there now that you can see and hardly can't tell what it is. Nahum thought it feeds on everything living and gets stronger all the time. He said he seen it this last week. It must be something from off in the sky, like the man from the college last year says the meteor stone was. The way it's made and the way it works ain't like no way of God's world. It's something from beyond." So the men paused, indecisively, as the light from the well grew stronger and the hitched horses pawed and whinnied in increasing frenzy. It was truly an awful moment, with terror in that ancient and accursed house itself. 4 monstrous sets of fragments, 2 from the house, 2 from the well, in the woodshed behind, and that shaft of unknown and unholy iridescence from the slimy depths in front. Ammy had restrained the driver on impulse, forgetting how uninjured he himself was after the clammy brushing of that coloured vapour in the attic room. Perhaps it's just as well that he acted as he did. No one will ever know what was abroad that night, and though the blasphemy from beyond had not so far hurt any human of unweakened mind, there is no telling what it might not have done at that last moment, and with its seemingly increased strength and the special signs of purpose it was soon to display beneath the half-clouded moonlit sky. All at once, one of the detectives at the window gave a short, sharp gasp. The others looked at him and then quickly followed his own gaze upward to the point at which his idle straying had been suddenly arrested. There was no need for words. What had been disputed in country gossip was disputable no longer, because a thing which every man of that party agreed in whispering later on, that strange days are never talked about in Arkham. It's necessary to premise that there was no wind at that hour of the evening. One did arise not long afterwards, but there was absolutely none then. Even the dry tips of the lingering hedge mustard, grey and blighted, and the fringe on the roof of the standing Democrat wagon were unstirred. And yet, amid that tense, godless calm, the high, bare boughs of the trees all in the yard were moving. They were twitching morbidly and spasmodically, clawing in convulsive and epileptic madness at the moonlit clouds, scratching impotently in the noxious air as if jerked by some allied and bodiless line of linkage with subterranean horrors writhing and struggling below the black roots. Not a man breathed for several seconds. Then a cloud of darker depth passed over the moon, and the silhouette of clutching branches faded out momentarily. At this, there was a general cry, muffled with awe, but husky and almost identical from every throat. For the terror had not faded with the silhouette, and in the fearsome instant of deeper darkness, the watchers saw, wriggling at the treetop height, a thousand tiny points of faint and unhallowed radiance tipped each bough like the fire of St. Elmo, or the flames that come down on the apostles' heads at Pentecost. It was a monstrous constellation of unnatural light, like a glutted swarm of corpse-fed fireflies dancing hellish sarabands over an accursed marsh, and its colour was that same nameless intrusion which Ami had come to recognise and dread. All the while, the shaft of phosphorescence from the well was getting brighter and brighter, bringing to the minds of the huddled men a sense of doom and abnormality which far outraced any image of their conscious minds could form. It was no longer shining out, it was pouring out, and as the shapeless stream of unplaceable colour left the well, it seemed to flow directly into the sky. The veterinary shivered, and walked to the front door to drop the extra heavy bar across it. Ami shook no less, and had to tug and point for a lack of controllable voice when he wished to draw notice of the growing luminosity of the trees. The neighing and stamping of the horses had become utterly frightful, but not a soul of the group in the old house would have ventured forth for any earthly reward. With the moments, the shining of the trees increased, while their restless branches seemed to strain more and more towards verticality. The wood of the well sweep was shining now, and presently a policeman dumbly pointed to some wooden sheds and beehives near the stone wall on the west. They were commencing to shine too, though the tethered vehicles of the visitors seemed so far unaffected. Then there was a wild commotion and a clopping in the road, and as Ami quenched the lamp for better seeing, they realized that the span of frantic greys had broken their sapling and run off with the Democrat wagon. The shock served to loosen several tongues, and embarrassed whispers were exchanged. "It spreads on everything organic that's been around here," muttered the medical examiner. No one replied, but the man who had just been in the well gave a hint that his long pole must have stirred something intangible. "It was awful," he added. "There was no bottom at all, just ooze and bubbles and the feeling of something lurking under there." Ami's horse still pawed and screamed deafeningly in the road outside, and nearly drowned its owner's faint quaver as he mumbled his formless reflections. "It come from that stone. It growed down there, got everything living, fed itself on him, mind and body. Thad and Merwin, Zenis and Nabby. Nahum was the last. They all drank the water. Got strong on him. It came from beyond, where things ain't like they be here. Now it's going home." At this point, as the column of unknown colour flared suddenly stronger and began to weave itself into a fantastic suggestion of shape which each spectator later described differently, there came from poor tethered hero such a sound as no man before or since had ever heard from a horse. Every person in that low-pitched sitting room stopped his ears, and Ami turned away from the window in horror and nausea. Words could not convey it, but when Ami looked out again, the hapless beast lay huddled inert on the moonlit ground between the splintered shafts of the buggy. That was the last of hero till they buried him the next day. But the present was no time to mourn, for almost at this instant a detective silently called attention to something terrible in the very room with them. In the absence of lamplight, it was clear that a faint phosphorescence had begun to pervade the entire apartment. It glowed on the broad planked floor where the rag carpet left it bare, and shimmered over the sashes of the small paned windows. It ran up and down the exposed corner posts, coruscated about the shelf and mantel, and infected the very doors and furniture. Each minute saw it strengthen, and at last it was very plain that healthy living things must leave that house. Ami showed them the back door and the path up through the fields to the 10-acre pasture. They walked and stumbled as in a dream, and did not dare look back till they were far away on the high ground. They were glad of the path, for they could have gone the front way by that well. It was a bad enough passing the glowing barn and sheds and those shining orchid trees with their gnarled, fiendish contours, but thank heaven the branches did their worst twisting high up. The moon went under some very black clouds as they crossed the rustic bridge over Chapman's Brook, and was blind groping from there to the open meadows. When they looked back towards the valley and the distant garden a place, the bottom they saw a fearsome sight. All the farm was shining with a hideous unknown blend of colour. Trees, buildings, and even such grass and herbage as had not been wholly changed to lethal grey brittleness. The boughs were all straining skyward, tipped with tongues of foul flame, and lambent tricklings of the same monstrous fire were creeping about the ridge poles of the house, barn, and sheds. It was a scene from a vision of Fuseli, and over the rest reigned that riot of luminous amorphousness, that alien and undimensioned rainbow of cryptic poison from the well, seething, feeling, lapping, reaching, scintillating, straining, and malignly bubbling in its cosmic and unrecognizable chromaticism. Then, without warning, the hideous thing shot vertically up towards the sky like a rocket or meteor, leaving behind no trail and disappearing through a round and curiously regular hole in the clouds before any man could gasp or cry out. No watcher can ever forget that sight, and Ami stared blankly at the stars of Cygnus, Deneb twinkling above the others, where the unknown color had melted into the Milky Way. But his gaze was the next moment called swiftly to earth by the crackling in the valley. It was just that. Only a wooden ripping and crackling, not an explosion, as so many others of the party vowed. Yet the outcome was the same, for in one feverish kaleidoscopic instant, there burst up from that doomed and accursed farm a gleamingly eruptive cataclysm of unnatural sparks and substance, blurring the glance of the few who saw it, and sending forth to the zenith a bombarding cloudburst of such colored and fantastic fragments as our universe must needs disown. Though quickly reclosing vapors, they followed the great morbidity that had vanished, and in another second they had vanished too. Behind and below was only a darkness to which the men dared not return, and all about was a mounting wind which seemed to sweep down in black, frore gusts from interstellar space. It shrieked and howled and lashed the fields and distorted woods in mad cosmic frenzy, till soon the trembling party realized it would be no use waiting for the moon to show what was left down there at Nahum's. Too awed to even hint theories, the seven shaking men trudged back towards Arkham by the north road. Ami was worse than his fellows and begged them to see him inside his own kitchen instead of keeping straight on to town. He did not wish to cross the blighted wind-whipped woods alone to his home on the main road, for he had an added shock that the others were spared and was crushed forever with a brooding fear he dared not even mention for many years to come. As the rest of the watchers on that tempestuous hill had stolidly set their faces towards the road, Ami had looked back an instant at the shadowy valley of desolation so lately sheltering his ill-starred friend. And from that stricken, faraway spot he had seen something feebly rise, only to sink again upon the place from which the great shapeless horror had shot it into the sky. It was just a colour, but not any colour of our earth or heavens, because Ami recognised that colour, and knew that this last faint remnant must still lurk down there in the well. He's never been quite right since. Ami would never go near the place again. It's 44 years now since that horror happened, but he has never been there, and will be glad when the new reservoir blots it out. I shall be glad too, for I do not like the way the sunlight changed colour around the mouth of that abandoned well I passed. I hope the water will always be very deep, but even so, I shall never drink it. I do not think I shall visit Arkham County thereafter. Three of the men who have been with Ami returned the next morning to see the ruins by daylight, but there were not any real ruins. Only the bricks of the chimney, the stones of the cellar, some mineral and metallic litter here and there in the rim of that nefandous well. Save for Ami's dead horse, which they towed away and buried, and the buggy which they shortly returned to him. Everything that had ever been living was gone. 5 eldritch acres of dusty, grey desert remained, nor has anything grown there since. To this day it sprawls open to the sky like a great spot eaten by acid in the woods and fields, and the few who have ever dared glimpse it in spite of the rural tales have named it the Blasted Heath. The rural tales are queer. They might be even queerer if city men and college chemists could be interested enough to analyse the water from that disused well, or the grey dust that no wind seems to ever disperse. Botanists, too, ought to study the stunted flora on the borders of that spot, for they might shed light on the country notion that the blight is spreading. Little by little, perhaps an inch a year. People say the colour of the neighbouring herbage is not quite right in the spring, and the wild things leave queer prints in the light winter snow. Snow never does seem quite so heavy on the blasted heath as elsewhere. Horses, the few that are left in this motor age, grow skittish in the silent valley, and hunters cannot depend on their dogs too near the splotch of greyish dust. They say the mental influences are very bad, too. Numbers went queer in the years after Nahum's taking, and they always lacked the power to get away. Then the stronger-minded folk all left the region, and only the foreigners tried to live in the crumbling old homesteads. They could not stay, though, and one sometimes wonders what insights beyond ours and their wild, weird stories of whispered magic had given them. Their dreams at night, they protest, are very horrible in that grotesque country, and surely the very look of the dark realm is enough to stir a morbid fancy. No traveller has ever escaped a sense of strangeness in these deep ravines, and artists shiver as they paint thick woods whose mystery is as much the spirit's as the eye. I myself am curious about the sensation I derive from my one lone walk before Ami told me his tale. When twilight came, I vaguely wished some clouds would gather, for odd timidity about the deep skyey voids above had crept into my soul. Do not ask me for my opinion. I do not know. That's all. There was no one but Amy to question, for Arkham people will not talk about the strange days, and all three professors who saw the aerial light in its coloured globule are dead. There were other globules, depend on that. One might have fed itself and escaped, and probably there was another which was too late. No doubt it is still there, down the well. I know there was something wrong with the sunlight I saw above that miasmal brink. The rustics say the blight creeps an inch a year, so perhaps there is a kind of growth or nourishment even now. But whatever demon is hatching there, it must be tethered to something else, or it would quickly spread. Is it fastened to the roots of those trees that claw the air? One of the current Arkham tales is about the fat oaks that shine and move as they ought not to do at night. What it is, only God knows. In terms of matter, I suppose the thing Amy described would be called a gas, but this gas obeyed laws that are not of our cosmos. There was no fruit of such world and suns as to shine on the telescopes and photographic plates of our observatories. There was no breath from the sky whose motions and dimensions our astronomers measure or deem too vast to measure. It was just a colour, out of space, a frightful messenger from unformed realms of infinity beyond all nature as we know it, from realms whose mere existence stuns the brain and numbs us with the black extra-cosmic gulfs it throws open before our frenzied eyes. I doubt very much if Amy consciously lied to me, and I do not think his tale was all a freak of madness as the town folk had warned. Something terrible came to the hills and valleys on that meteor, and something terrible, though I know not what, in proportion still remains. I shall be glad to see the water come. Meanwhile, I hope nothing will happen to Amy. He saw so much of the thing and its influence was so insidious. Why has he never been able to move away? How clearly he recalled those dying words of Nahum. Can't get away. Draws ye. Ye know something's coming, but tain't no use. Amy is such a good man when the reservoir gang gets to work, I must write the chief engineer to keep a sharp watch on him. I would hate to think of him as the grey, twisted, brittle monstrosity which persists more and more in troubling my sleep. This is one of my favorite Lovecraft stories. When I first read it, I did not have as good a handle on the idea of cosmic horror as I do now, and I did not have the place in history that Lovecraft occupied in my head, so I wasn't really quite aware of what was going on in the same way that I am now. Particularly of note, the idea of radiation and damage of radioactivity is not as widely known. There's multiple times where Lovecraft uses the term nuclear in other works to refer to simply a thing with a nucleus or a center. So the way that this story seems to reflect on a radioactive presence that's capable of causing terrible damage to the world around it in an almost Chernobyl-like way is effectively an invention of the man's imagination. Now, that's not to say that the story is missing of our classic mainstays of Lovecraft, because when he wanted to talk about a space that was cursed and terrible and that sensible people avoided, he couldn't help but bung on that, oh yeah, foreigners even tried it and they couldn't handle it, because ultimately Lovecraft thought of foreigners as being horrible and dirty and nasty, because, you know, he wasn't a great guy, and when he wanted to evoke the idea of a horrible dance of lights, the term he used was flesh-fed fireflies saraband. A saraband is a Spanish dance in triple time. So that was his idea. Like, you know, what if fireflies ate human flesh and then danced like Spaniards? Which, you know, that right there, that is some vintage racism. You don't normally get racism that goes, ah, the swarthy Spaniard. There's also the use of the term rustic to refer to an entire category of people who, by all observation, were just remarkably tough. The science in here is as soft as cheese, and the color out of space isn't even called that until the very end of the story. There's a lot of restraint here. There is perhaps a bit too much gilding of the lily. I don't know if you've noticed this, but this is an hour long. But it is a good, solid, spooky story. It has a fairly obvious framing problem as well, where apparently this scientist from Arkham who came to attend to the reservoir is one framing device, and then they encounter and talk to Amy, who provides a second framing device, but the story as related through Amy is completely inaccurate to the type of voice we hear Amy use. So there's that.
There's also the way that the quote-unquote rustics have a phonetic accent written for them. I wanted to avoid doing too many voices in this one, but there really was no avoiding it. That's how they were written. I think this is a really good, creepy story of cosmic horror. I imagine that if you wanted to approach it today, you could do the same thing more or less with a sort of fourth dimensional radioactive cosmic monster. The fact that the color out of space is never personalized, despite the fact that it does terrible things, it doesn't seem to care. Like, it doesn't act out of malice at any point. You don't see it inflicting revenge. It really just seems to be consuming resources around it, and the degree to which it's aware of that is completely unknown. Obviously, Lovecraft thought of it as malicious, but Lovecraft thought of literally everything as malicious. And there's also a very archaic vision of the ideas of how space works. The notion that once you leave Earth's atmosphere, you are out in the ether, and the whole set of rules of physics apply differently. That's pretty interesting. Anyway, thank you very much if you've listened this far. I'm going to say the word aardvark.